This podcast features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2011 annual conference. The session is by Michael McRobbie, president of Indiana University, and is entitled IT from Both Sides of the Executive Table.
Thank you for being here, whether you are in Philadelphia or those of you back there who are online for the closing session of the EDUCAUSE annual conference. And as we leave the conference today, there are just three things that I'd like to ask you to think about. The first one is that they say that leaders learn faster than the world is changing. And our world is certainly changing quickly, whether it's the technology or the institutions or the policies, all of those things. And I hope you will continue to look to EDUCAUSE for leadership and for learning on the issues that matter most to higher education. The second thing that I would ask you to think about is that you don't have to go it alone. Remember, EDUCAUSE is a community, and it's your community. Communities solve problems, they inspire, they support each other. And it doesn't matter where you work or live. Your colleagues and your association will be there for you. And the final is that higher education matters absolutely more than it ever has before, and IT has more to contribute than it ever has before. So I hope you will contribute to the uncommon thinking for the common good, because we can make a difference. Now, as you leave today, I hope you leave informed and energized. I hope you are leaving with new friends and colleagues. And I want to thank the many, many volunteers in EDUCAUSE, both for the conference and the association, because you are what makes the association great. And I want to particularly highlight one set of volunteers who are terribly important to us, and that is the EDUCAUSE Board of Directors, because the board provides us with guidance, with strategic direction, and pushes us to be sure that we do the best we can to serve our members. So on behalf of the EDUCAUSE Board of Directors, I'd like to introduce our chair, David Lasner.
Aloha. I'm glad to see all of you here and be able to welcome those of you who are joining us online. I hope you've all found this to be a wonderful week of connection and reconnection with great colleagues, transformative ideas, and communities of practice. EDUCAUSE and our programs can only be as good as we all support them in being. And as Diana just mentioned, member volunteers do much of the critical work of the organization, primarily through our committees, advisory bodies, and initiatives. We owe you all much appreciation for your unselfish sharing in making this all possible. But even if you aren't currently serving in any formal role, we need all of our members to provide input and feedback so that EDUCAUSE's activities and future directions maintain a strong focus on our needs as professionals and those of our institutions. One group of volunteers, the EDUCAUSE Board, has special responsibility for the association's governance, making sure we're headed in the right directions and under sound professional and financial management. For those of you who weren't at the business meeting, I'm delighted to assure you all that under the excellent stewardship of Diana, the management, and the staff of EDUCAUSE, we are financially healthy, very healthy. This has made it easier for the board to encourage the organization to take some risks and place some bets to get us to the future. We're committed to helping EDUCAUSE stay ahead of the curve as an organization, and we want EDUCAUSE to be a powerful agent that is widely recognized for helping our institutions and our communities succeed and advance. Your board tries to listen carefully, and we broadly monitor the changing landscape both within our institutions and around our institutions. We engage in lively conversation and debate about what would be best for the entire membership. We don't all agree all of the time. I don't know why. But we all have a shared commitment to working together and focusing on how our institutions can effectively leverage IT as a transformative agent to advance our missions and our communities. So let me take this opportunity to introduce my fellow board members, including three who just joined us for the first meeting here in Philadelphia. Each individual brings a wealth of knowledge, experience, and expertise to their EDUCAUSE service. And after I've identified all of them, I'll ask them to stand and be recognized as a group. Debbie Allison, Joel Cooper, Ted Dodds, James Hilton, Tom Mayer, Richard Northam, Patty Orr, Carrie Regenstein, Vernon Smith, Randy Stiles, Brad Wheeler, and our newest board members, Kara Freeman, Susan Mitros, and Brian Voss. Please join me in thanking them all for their service. And I'm now pleased to present one of our organization's many hardworking volunteers, the chair of the 2011 EDUCAUSE Annual Conference Program Committee, who will introduce our speaker. Please welcome back to the stage Mark Brune, Associate Vice President for Public Safety and Institutional Assurance at Indiana University. Mark.
Thank you, David. Good morning to all. Thank you all for a great conference experience here in Philadelphia. Your engagement and participation is really what makes this event highly valuable. I want to thank the program committee down here in front and the EDUCAUSE staff for their hard work. Both groups of people excellent to work with. The EDUCAUSE staff makes things so much easier to do. We will reconvene next year in Denver or online. Please mark your calendars for that conference, November 6th through the 9th, 2012. Our closing speaker, Michael A. McRobbie, became Indiana University's 18th president on July 1st, 2007. As president, he is responsible for IU's 8-campus system, which has a total budget of around $3 billion, over 5,000 faculty, 11,000 staff, and most recently, 110,000 students. But his contribution to IU started much earlier than that. In 1997, Michael became the IU's vice president for IT and CIO, and he led IU to national prominence in that area. The dramatic revolution in IT at IU was fueled by his extensive and first-ever IT strategic plan for the university, which is now considered a model for other institutions. As VP for IT, he was directly involved in the creation of the IU School of Informatics, development of iLight, Indiana's statewide higher education network, development of the IU Global Network Operations Center, which started with Internet 2 Abilene in 1998 and now manages over 50 state, national, and international networks, creation of IU's pervasive technology labs, which were funded by $30 million from the Lilly Endowment, the largest private research grant to IU at that time, and close to my heart, he created the University Information Security and Policy Offices, likely the first of their kind in higher education at that time, created the IU Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research, and he oversaw the creation of the IU-based Research and Education Networking Information Sharing and Analysis Center, ran ISAC, with which many of your security staff interacts every day. His accomplishments were recognized when he was named one of the premier 100 IT leaders by Computer World magazine. In 2003, Michael took on additional responsibilities as Vice President for Research, and 3 years later was appointed Interim Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs for IU Bloomington. In making its decision to appoint him as President, the IU Board of Trustees praised Michael's extensive 10-year record of accomplishment, his strong academic credentials, his proclivity for fostering research partnerships, and his highly effective collaborative leadership style. A native of Australia, you won't be able to tell, Michael came to IU from the Institute of Advanced Study at the Australian National University, where he was a professor of IS and CEO of the Cooperative Research Center for Advanced Computational Systems. He earned a bachelor's degree with first-class honors and a doctoral degree from the University of Queensland. Michael is an honorary member of the Alliance of Distinguished and Titled Professors and an honorary member of the Australian Academy of Humanities. In 2007, Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels named him a Sagamore of the Wabash, the state of Indiana's highest honor. As president, he continues to support IT as fundamental to university success. On a personal note, I am grateful for the guidance Michael has given me as he has entrusted me with increasing and challenging responsibilities within and most recently outside of IT. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Michael McRobbie.
Thanks very much, Mark. I have to apologize that I'm getting over a cold, which will no doubt make an Australian accent. I guess you hadn't worked out that I'm Australian by origin. That will make an Australian accent even more incomprehensible to you. So my apologies for that. I want to take just a minute to just recognize some people, take this opportunity. I was, as Mark said, given the opportunity to lead for about 10 years a truly marvelous and outstanding information technology organization at Indiana University, and now so ably led by Brad Wheeler. And I would just like to thank all of the people, and there are hundreds of them, and I know quite a few are here, for all that they have, all that they did and all that they continue to do at the university, but to contribute to their discipline and to their profession. They really are an extraordinary group of outstanding people, and it was a real honor to have led them for 10 years. I would like to also pay tribute to the man I worked for as president for 6 years, who was Miles Brand, who was a truly great university president and who sadly died a few years ago. It was, I think, an enormous loss to the community of presidents in this country. And I was pleased that in a very small way we were able to recognize him by establishing a chair, the Miles Brand Chair in Pancreatic Cancer Research, which he died in his honor, which we recently filled with an outstanding scientist as well. I'd also like to say what a pleasure it was in the period that I was CIO, about 10 years, to work with a whole range of very distinguished and able CIOs around the country, and in particular the colleagues that I had, and there were many of them, and I'll name just a few, the colleagues that I work with on the CIC, that is the roughly the Big Ten CIOs. We used to meet about four times a year, and I used to find that one of the most pleasurable meetings that I had, because it was a wonderful way to test out ideas and learn from a bunch of very able colleagues. And I mentioned in particular Greg Jackson, of course, now working for EDUCAUSE, Gary Augustin, James Hilton, Jim Bottom, but there were many, many others as well, and it was a real pleasure to work with those colleagues. I should also mention in the context of IU that I'm delighted that to also recognize a number of colleagues who I think have gone on to great things. I know Brian Voss is here somewhere. There you are, Brian. Now the CIO at Maryland, a great contributor when he was at IU. Jacob Levin, and now Vice President at Amazon as well. It was a great pleasure to work with those people. And finally, let me just pay tribute to Diana Romliger for the wonderful job I think she's done. I haven't been really much associated with EDUCAUSE for quite a while, but the transformative effect that she has had as a leader, I think, is really quite tangible, I think, in everything one now hears and sees about the organization too. So I think you should be very pleased that you have such fine leadership in this organization. Well, when I was asked to talk to you, I said, look, I can't really talk about technology anymore because I'm not that current, and I don't think people want to hear about NCAA reform and issues like that. But I don't think they want to hear about other issues that one has to work on in higher education. I was told, well, you are allegedly the only CIO who ever became a president. So just tell them about what you now think of what are the major issues in information technology from your point of view as a president, and what's changed in your thinking, what is important from your point of view as a president. But our preference is you don't read a speech and drone on endlessly or give a lengthy, innovating PowerPoint presentation and to talk more informally, which is going to be my goal in doing this. I am mindful, though, that the late great Steve Jobs once spoke to you. I was there where he said, well, I really haven't got much I want to talk to you about. I'm happy to answer questions, and sat down on the edge of the stage and took questions, which is, I suppose, another approach I could take as well. But let me just try and focus what I'm going to say in six different areas, and hopefully I'll get to comment on all of these areas. I want to talk firstly in very broad, expansive terms about the mission of a university or an institution of higher education. I want to talk about the funding challenges of our institutions. I want to talk about centralization of information technology. I'm, by the way, in favor of it. I want to talk about risks and the whole problem of risk management in an institution. I want to talk about briefly about the role of the CIO in this day and age. And at the end of it, I want to talk about people in IT. So let me start by talking about mission. And when one thinks about universities and tries to distill down what the essence of the mission of a university is, and by university I'm using the term very expansively again to incorporate all kinds of institutions that carry out some form of education post-secondary, they really have three missions. The creation of knowledge, that is what we call research, the dissemination of knowledge, teaching and learning, and the preservation of knowledge. Now, that process of preservation is, when one thinks about it, and it's not necessarily always top of our agenda, but that process of preservation really has been one of the most distinctive hallmarks of universities throughout the world. When one thinks about even the ancient academies, Plato's Academy, all those three missions were true of the Plato's Academy. They wanted to disseminate the knowledge, that is the learning, the philosophy that came from Socrates. They wanted to react to it and create new philosophical knowledge, and they, of course, wanted to preserve, as they did through the Platonic dialogues and elsewhere, all of this knowledge as well. But a key thing about universities is that they are immensely old. Universities, in general, are one of the oldest forms of human organization. They are maybe the oldest form of, or the oldest human institution, apart from the Catholic Church. And you're probably familiar with some of the dates, but it starts to put things in perspective. Bologna, arguably founded first in 1088, Oxford 1096, Paris 1150, and Cambridge in 1209. But there are even older institutions. The university that President Obama spoke at so eloquently in Egypt, Al-Azhar University, founded in 970. And Al-Karawin University in Fez, Morocco, founded in 859. However, there are institutions that claim to be even older. The University of Nanjing actually claims to have uninterrupted operations in some form since 258 BCE, before the Christian era, which makes it older than the Catholic Church, of course. And by that standard, Harvard in 1636 and my own university, 1820, are just titulars in terms of institutions. And of course there are universities that have existed historically that no longer exist. The oldest maybe is Taxila University, which is near Islamabad in Pakistan, or was near Islamabad in Pakistan, founded in the 6th century. And Nalanda in India, founded in 427, destroyed in 1197, 427 BCE, destroyed in 1197, existed for over 1,600 years. So universities and institutions are immensely long-lived. And if one was to take a bet on whether some of our major information technology companies that exist today would exist in 100 years' time versus my own institution or the institutions of many other people in this room, I think the wise person would put the money on those institutions of higher education. Well, so why is this relevant? Let me talk about a study that I had carried out when I was still in the job as CIO. And it was prompted, the particular committee that I put together was prompted by claims being made at the time as to what researchers needed. It was a claim about a certain kind of network connectivity that researchers needed. My background is in information technology, computer science, and I felt that I was a researcher and I felt these claims were not accurate, not true. But of course I probably had a vested interest. So I set up a committee where I tried to get as many of our most distinguished faculty members of the various national academies and so on across the university, various disciplines, humanities, sciences and so on that Brad Wheeler chaired for me. And I asked them to tell me, looking down the road, what was it that researchers of their quality, and these are people who aren't people who are really become completely enamored of IT and really becoming IT people. These are people who want to win Nobel Prizes in medicine or physics, and they're focused on their discipline. I wanted to hear from them, what was it that was important to them, what was going to be important to them in the next 20 or 30 years. And the three major areas were going to be high-performance network connectivity, high-performance computing, and storage. And the response that came back was that people were pretty happy with networking and they could see where it was going. They understood at that stage, as is the case now, but had not been the case 20 years ago, that high-performance computing is really just a matter of dollars. You've got X million dollars, and that'll buy you X million teraflops, and that's really all there is to it. An area that had once been exotic and highly risky, I think, has now become extremely mundane in that regard. Not that the technology and the results aren't important, they're extremely important, but getting there is now a lot simpler than it used to be. The area that they came back and advocated for was storage. They wanted to be able to store all their experimental data generated by their equipment, no matter whether it was in biology or astronomy or cyclotrons or neutron devices. I mean, all of that, they wanted to be able to store their data. They wanted to be able to store their analysis of it. They wanted to be able to store all of their information. And they wanted to be able to store it in vast quantities. And there were two, I think, particularly telling remarks that came out of that report that are as relevant today as they were when that report was done. One of them was one of the faculty members who's since become a National Academy member said, I want to be able to store the data not just for my students, but for my students' students. And another person said that he wanted to store the data, noise and all, because today's noise is tomorrow's information with the development of better algorithms to extract information out of noise. So that led to the establishment of what we used to refer to colloquially as our data parking lot, which is now I think a 2 petabyte plus hierarchical storage system which we established now about 5 years ago, which is roughly comparable to the system at SDSC that was established, I think, in the last year or so as well. And it was aimed specifically at providing massive storage for our scientists. Now, the point that links what I started with and that together is as follows. Researchers are not very good at the long-term preservation and curation of data, by which I mean quite often this is done by a graduate student working over the summer, and that graduate student graduates and goes away, and whatever particular way in which that was encoded and stored and what have you tends to disappear with the graduate student. So if one views this data as being of particular importance where it is not replicable, I mean, anything that you can generate out of a model is replicable. But data that is, for example, in an area of the life sciences or health sciences, a shot of various factors about someone's blood chemistry or something like that is never going to be the same the next day. So in that sense, it's not replicable. Astronomical data of astronomical phenomena is not replicable, and so on. I mean, in fact, when one thinks about it, it may be that the great bulk of data generated in science is not replicable. So the question of the long-term storage of the data starts to become particularly significant, becomes particularly important. So what we decided to do was, well, who are the people in the university who actually have some idea who work with the question of the long-term curation of data? And those people, of course, are the people in information systems. I want to know as president about budgetary issues. I certainly want to know with respect to the history of our donors who were students 40 years ago, information about them 40 years ago. So the digital records of an institution at least go back 40 years, if not more, if you digitize what goes before the digital era and so on. And, of course, it is the information systems people who are in the institution, no matter what they're called and no matter what part of the institution they exist in, who are most proficient and who have the most developed technologies and methodologies and what have you for dealing with the long-term curation of data. So what we did was to try to bring together both the people on the research side of the university with the IS people with a view to viewing the data on the data store as not something that would disappear with the vicissitudes of the career of a graduate student, but which would stay around for and be available for that National Academy's members, graduate students in the future. But of course, it raises a larger question: who would one ultimately want to entrust that data to 40, 50, 100 years out as well? Well, I've already indicated that universities are institutions of extraordinary longevity. And universities, again, I think if one was to look at what will be the best bet for the long-term preservation of digital data, it will be universities. Now, of course, part of the secret of preservation of data is the replication of the data over multiple sites, which in turn implies that we have to become better at building long-term, persistent, consortial arrangements between institutions of a kind that I think we're only just starting to learn how to do in IT anyway, in a sustained way at the moment. I remember John Chambers, the CEO of and chair of Cisco, one of our alums, John Chambers, saying at a meeting once that, and this was maybe 5 years ago, he said something like, of the 10 networking companies that had existed 5 years before that, only three were still in business. And there's an interesting list when one thinks about all the great IT companies, many of whom have dominated your lives and mine for decades, that no longer exist. And just off the top of my mind, I put down Sun, Wang, Dex, Storage Tech, Compaq, Controlled Data, Thinking Machines, Commodore, Sequent, Atari, and I'm sure that in a few minutes we could collectively come up with 100 names between us here as well. So the point here is that I believe that universities are really the organizations who should be directly concerned with this issue of the long-term preservation and curation, and by long-term I mean not just decades but centuries of data, and that this is directly relevant to one of the three fundamental missions of higher education, the preservation of knowledge. And it is no different to preserve that data than it was for the Platonists in Plato's Academy to preserve the Platonic dialogues that still exist 25 centuries later. So that's the first point I wanted to make about mission. And I make those comments as a president who looks at this question through the lens of of the those centuries of the history of the universities and thinking about what will be important to my successors in 100 years' time. I mean, we are all just entrusted for a short period of time with responsibility for institutions. And it's not just the pressures of today that we have to deal with and resolve on a day-to-day basis, but it is thinking out that far ahead. And I make these comments without getting into the, I'm sure, lengthy doctrinal arguments that we could have about clouds and their pluses and minuses. But I think in thinking through how one aligns a university with that new technology phenomena for which there is such enthusiasm, one needs to think about what are the long-term interests of a university and what are universities really good at. That's the first point. Now, let me say something. I wanted to say something next about funding. This is not unrelated. The thing that we've all seen, and I'm sure this affects everybody here and it affects you whether you live in the United States or you come from overseas, and I'm aware this is an international conference, the recession has brought major pressure to bear on all of us in higher education, both publics and privates. It's varied from institution to institution, but we are all suffering severe pressures in that regard. Just today, there was a report in the paper about what's happening in Chile with occupation of their Senate there by people protesting about wanting free education, protesting about issues in education there. Of course, one remembers the riots in the UK not so long ago as well. I noticed that it's one of the demands of the Occupy Wall Street movement, in as much as that is a coherent movement, for lower tuition and student debt is an issue they've raised it, as well. Universities have five sources of income, and these obviously vary depending on whether you're private or public. And those are tuition, the appropriation one gets as a public university as we are from the state, funding from the federal government, philanthropy, and clinical and other income. Those are the five sources. In every one of those cases, those sources of income are under severe pressure. Tuition because of the, I think, widespread concern that higher education is becoming unaffordable. State appropriations because most states are in very difficult financial situations, and the states that have so generously funded their public universities for so long are no longer able to do so in the way that they did 30 or 40 years ago. Federal funding is, I think, in at least for the foreseeable future, in irrevocable decline. I've just come from a meeting of AAU presidents. We heard from the director of the NIH, and I think the NIH is preparing for a significant cut in NIH funding. I think the NSF, at best, will see flat funding. In real terms, it's a decline in funding as well. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. Philanthropy is under pressure, though it may be the one bright spot here, but philanthropy really has a major impact, probably only on 30 or 40 or maybe 100 institutions in a major way in this country, and probably even less so overseas, because there doesn't tend to be a well-developed culture of philanthropy internationally. And finally, clinical income and related incomes, but clinical income in particular coming from hospital systems, and of course in this country at least, that's under pressure too because of the impact of healthcare reform. So every single source of income from the university is under pressure. I think that the message that I would want to convey here is that I don't believe we are going to see this change ever. I think we're now, this is the new situation. The cliche that's bandied about is the new normal. This really is the new normal, I think, for higher education. And we will be under more pressure to become more productive. And more productive means time to degree. It means improving graduation rates. And there, people are very mindful of the fact that graduates have about half the unemployment rate of non-graduates. and twice as much lifetime income as well. We're going to be under pressure to move from what was effectively an agrarian model of education with a long summer break to educating the whole year round and so on as well. Now, much of the productivity in America anyway, and probably true of much of the rest of the world, since World War II has been due to technology, according to some economists as well. And most industries have been restructured due to the prodigious impact of technology as well. One of the few areas that hasn't, of course, is healthcare, where though people, I think, are now talking about it with a seriousness they never have before, you still quite often, when you go to see a doctor, have to fill out forms. The notion of the electronic health record has still not had any kind of substantive impact in healthcare more generally as well. And another area where I think the full impact of IT is yet to be felt is in universities, in higher education. And there, of course, one area is going to be the full impact of online education once it's possible to solve the issue of its expense. At the moment, it's arguable that it's more expensive than classical education. When that changes, and there are many people working on how to do that, when or if that changes, then that will have, I think, a significant impact on the economics of higher education. I did, though, not want to talk so much about that, but just comment on what I think has been something that is a development that has come out of this community here that is having and should be able to have a very significant impact on the cost of education, that is the cost of running a university, and that is the impact of open source software. I can speak from the point of view of our own institution that the savings that we have made through the widespread deployment of a number of the major open source software systems has been many tens of millions of dollars, and that has flown from either by, in terms of savings or in terms of costs avoided into the academic mission of the institution, and that is going to be the pressure that all of you and all of us are going to be over in the past. And obviously, Indiana University's had a significant role in this particular initiative, but I want to both endorse and commend it. And I should note that this is a model that has been widely used in science, certainly in my scientific career. When I started as a graduate student, much of the software we used was open source software developed by other researchers that was just spread around the world and used. And it's worked very well in the scientific community for a variety of complicated reasons. It has not worked so well, or that model for the development of software has not worked so well in the broader IT professional community. Well, I think all that changed, and this is something that I would defer for the history of this to other people, but I think broadly speaking, this changed when Sakai, which was a project that we were involved in with MIT and Stanford in Michigan, when Sakai was deployed around about 2000, or announced and deployed around about 2004. And in our institution, again, I want to pay great credit to Brad Wheeler as a person who really was responsible for leading that particular effort at IU. And the savings to us there, and I think the savings to other institutions, and now there are hundreds of universities worldwide who are members of the consortium and using Sakai in a form that's suitable to them, has been immense to higher education. And it is a classic case, and it's related to the very first point I made. It's a case of the universities having direct control over a part of their infrastructure, which at least for the foreseeable future is going to be fundamental to what they do. And of course, the Kuali system, which now is really comprises eight different systems as well, that was based on the financial information system developed at Indiana University by Barry Walsh, but now being deployed in anger, as they say, across many institutions worldwide, is again, I think, another great example of very significant cost savings flowing out of an initiative in universities that enables universities to take control of their own destiny in what is obviously a fundamental part of what they do, which is the management of their of not only their financial resources but their other resources as well. And I saw Barry in the bar last night and was reminiscing about the time he came to sell me on this project, and want to pay great tribute to him and all the others I think who made this something such a successful project as well. And while there, let me just also say that I was very early on a member of a committee chaired by John Hennessy, the president of Stanford, when I was still the CIO, that was responsible, I think, for providing the support to Ira Fuchs, who was then the vice president at the Mellon Foundation, and to Bill Bowen, who was then the president, for them to go ahead and start the program of investment in open source systems that I think was critical to enabling and provided the independent validation for those projects that I think enabled them certainly in part to become successful. And I think Ira and Bill Bowen deserve great credit for their efforts there. I wanted to mention that in particular because I think that there is considerable debate. I hear it from other presidents and other people. There's considerable debate about the importance of open source software and how viable it is as a model. And I wanted to make sure that I made it clear that I both commend those people responsible and I endorse this model as a model for the future development of software as well. I could mention other models out there. I think Internet 2 has done a great job in terms of providing very substantial bandwidth to all the institutions that were connected to the Internet 2 backbone to support research computing and other forms of information technology, cyber infrastructure more generally in this country. But I don't want to dwell on that. I could mention eText as another example of where I think very significant savings are going to be available to the university. We announced an eText agreement with a range of publishers recently that will have a direct impact on the cost of education to our students. And there are similar agreements out there. And I'm sure that many of you have either done or will be carrying out similar kinds of implementations with other vendors as well, and I think that provides another substantial opportunity for savings. And of course, there is the whole issue of e-journals and what the role is of universities in the ownership of the intellectual property generated by their faculty and their students as well. And that, of course, is an issue of under considerable discussion and has been for a while, for which there are many posited solutions as well. Let me now say something about centralization. I am and have been for most of my career an unashamed believer in the centralization of IT where this is appropriate. Now that isn't a clever hedge to allow everything through, but I'm very mindful that the right balance is balance between the centralization of services and infrastructure where that makes sense. For an institution where it is technically feasible and where the savings are demonstrable, and of course the great bulk of users who use services generated by or deployed through those central services, and of course now who are all highly mobile and who utilize mobile devices for the great bulk of what they're doing in information technology, but who in some form are using the services provided by the universities as well. And I think the basic argument for centralization, I don't think has changed from what it was when I first came to IU, you know, about 15 years ago. And the argument was just starting to, I think, really take hold around that time. What you had seen up until, say, roughly the mid-90s was this utterly heterogeneous mix of operating systems. You probably couldn't have identify what was going to be the dominant operating systems, although it was probably getting clear by the mid-90s. But before that, certainly 5 years before that, there were other competitors out there to what ultimately became the dominant operating systems. There were competing networking protocols. I remember in the mid-90s, people were still making the case for SNA and DECnet. I remember that from in various quarters, people were saying, well, the TCP/IP is not really what we need for the internet. We really have to develop something better. And when that comes, then we'll really be able to do this, this, and this. Well, of course, that never happened. And TCP/IP is the basis of all networking. Now, I'm well aware that there are projects that will ultimately maybe lead to changes there as well, but they weren't the projects envisioned back then. Desktop productivity tools, there was, I think, a great heterogeneous mix of those. Desktop computers, you know, what was the right, who was going to be the dominant supplier, and there's a great variety of those as well. But with the relentless commoditization of IT, driven really by Moore's Law, which just kept grinding away and continues to keep grinding away, I never thought that I'd get to the end of my career, which hopefully is a long way off, with Moore's Law having finally reached its limits. But I think it looks to me like Moore's Law will continue to relentlessly grind on for at least to the end of this decade, based on the technology projections that I've seen. I'm sure you're all now more familiar with than I am as well. And with that commoditization, it no longer became the case that a department and a university could claim, well, we're using, you know, this and this, and this is how we do it in my discipline, and we have to do it this way, and so keep away from us, and we're going to continue to run this. I think those arguments died a long time ago. I'm amazed that you still see them around in institutions, that the cases will be made for, no, we're special. We have this special application that means that we have to control it. When you look at it, it's just an application running on a Windows machine or something like that can easily be run on a machine that's centralized with a lot of savings to that school or department. So certainly as far as our institution is concerned, we have progressively, I don't think we're finished, but we have been progressively centralizing the server infrastructure in the institution, for which not only are there good economic reasons, but there are also good, of course, security reasons, as many of you know. And this is something that if you have a board, as we do and many other institutions do, with business people on them, they will look at industry and they'll look at what happens in industry with the centralization of IT services in industry. They'll look at universities and say, well, why are you different? And it is very hard to make a case for us being that much different to what, in terms of the fundamental infrastructure. Now, I'm well aware you can make a case for exceptions in a variety of areas, embedded processes, experimental architectures, et cetera, but the arguments to sustain uniqueness, I think, are getting harder and harder, and they all ultimately support greater centralization of IT resources. And the savings are immense. The savings really are huge. I mean, just one example, I can't remember the exact figures, but when we moved to consolidated purchasing of desktop machines rather than allowing every department to do their own deal and go out and buy machines, that saved us over a number of years tens of millions of dollars, genuine savings that flowed back to the various schools and departments in the institution. In fact, I remember once that the way we had it structured was there was a matching fund from the schools where money was escrowed from a lot of the schools, and the discounts through bulk purchasing thousands of units at a time were so substantial that we faced a financial shortfall in the university. And at one of President Brand's cabinet meetings, when this issue was being discussed, I said, well, we've actually done so well that we have a surplus in this particular account from the schools that we can give back to them that will address this particular financial issue, sort of making me a hero for a day, at least anyway, in the institution. Let me say something now about risks, and I'll try and speed up just a little, because I wanted to leave just a little time if people want to ask any questions. By risks, I'm... I'm particularly, I'm going to start by talking about cybersecurity as a major area of risk, but certainly as a president, one of the things that you are most sensitive to are the risks across the institution that you need to be aware of, that you need to know who's responsible for the mitigation of that risk and for the overall management of that risk. Cybersecurity, I, in the interest of time, I won't say too much about this, except that we progressively, under Mark's leadership, Mark Bruin's leadership, we progressively built up our cybersecurity capabilities in the university over a number of years to an organization of about 20 people. I mean, we're a big university, so that's probably about appropriate. And went from, I think, a situation with almost no policy, no people apart from Mark and Tom Davis, who were basically locked away in an office somewhere and allowed to come out occasionally to deal with problems, to an office that really had the ability to deal with the range of IT issues, cybersecurity issues across the institution. But we realized after a while that, of course, I think as everybody knows, that cybersecurity incidents involve more than just the cybersecurity people. It involves the general counsel, the auditor, your campus PD, if you have one, HR, information management people, and many others as well that you can come up with. And one of the things I wanted to do was to improve research at the university. So we set up a center that brought to the table all of the people who are heads or key practitioners in all of those areas with our researchers in cybersecurity who are scattered around the university. It's called the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research, which has become extremely successful, led in turn to the development of that as one of the specialities of our School of Informatics. And, of course, we also established about the same time the Research and Education Networking Information Sharing and Analysis Center, which is the a body that deals with cybersecurity incidents on the 50-odd networks that Mark mentioned before that we manage. But when I became president in 2007, and I had given Mark a slightly more expanded role before that when I was provost, one of the issues that I confronted was we had no one office in the university responsible for cybersecurity, responsible for overall safety and security for the whole university. There were individual officers spread across the university, but quite often I, as president, would be finding out about incidents that had happened on one of our campuses or even on the main campuses where I spend most of my time, reading about it in the paper or hearing it from people at cocktail parties and so on. And, of course, this is unacceptable. But not, I mean, not only am I not hearing it, but other people that need to hear it. Well, not only was I not hearing it, other people weren't hearing it. But there was a question as to whether all the people who needed to be engaged in an incident were engaged. So, and this is more an example of how the IT organization and cybersecurity was a leader. It doesn't have to be. There's nothing unique about it here. But how we were then able to leverage off what was a very well-developed organization to establish a new office, and that's the Office of Assurance and Public Safety, and Mark is the Associate VP for that. So in one office, what we brought together was responsibility for cybersecurity, obviously, information management, physical security and access, personal institutional privacy, general regulatory and policy compliance, environmental health and safety, emergency management, campus and departmental continuity, both business and academic, and all aspects of academic, and public safety and policing. So all of that is now brought together in one office with leadership through Mark and an organizational structure that enables us to, I think, have a much better ability to manage risk in the institution than we had before. No one will ever claim that they're perfect in that regard, and we continue to improve, and we will always continue to improve. But at least now we have one person who has an overall perspective on all of those issues and is in a position to be able to know how to comprehensively address risk issues that are raised and and be able to respond accordingly. I will say just two final things, since I seem to have used up all the time. The role of the CIO, I've noted that there seems in some quarters to be a diminishing maybe of the, this may be unfair, but I've certainly heard this from many people, a diminishing of the role of the CIO in institutions. And I think that there could be no more important time than now for the CIO to be a senior officer of the university and have a role, if not reporting directly to the president, then certainly reporting to the provost of an institution or the equivalent of the provost as well. I think this person has control of vital resources in the institution. They have the ability to have a significant impact on the financial bottom line of the institution through some of the things I've mentioned and hundreds of other areas as well. And as I've also indicated, they can play a major role. Certainly they do through cybersecurity, but they can play a major role in risk mitigation throughout an institution as well, in the context of what I described, which is really what's called an all-hazards approach as well. And it really requires the oversight and direction of somebody with that strategic vision to be able to see how to pull all of those pieces together, who not only can communicate down to his or her fellow technologists, but is capable of communicating up to people who aren't necessarily that knowledgeable about the intricacies of what they do. And I think we may have gone through a quiet period in IT. I mean, IT is like the physics of the sun. I mean, it goes through quiet periods, but I think at the moment it is white hot, and I think there is probably, this is as important time as has ever been for the CIO to have a seat at the table with the president of an institution. And finally, let me just say something about people. I remember when I arrived at Indiana University, there was a slogan that the IT organization had, which was, and Brian will remember this, which was, it was a privilege to serve. And I banned this because I didn't want the metaphor for IT to be the metaphor of servitude. I wanted it to be the metaphor of partnership. And by this I mean that I think it's absolutely essential for the IT organization to have to run first-class, cost-effective, efficient services. That's its number one mission, and it has to do that. But provided it does that, the IT professionals, many of whom are highly skilled technologists, many with advanced degrees, need to be thought of as a way of leveraging the research capabilities of an institution and to be partners to the researchers of the university, to write papers, to be partners in experiments, to teach, to supervise students, all of which we've been able to do to greater or less extent at our institution. So to me, one has to, the way one needs to look at the IT organization is first and foremost it's providing services, but then it's a multiplier of the research capabilities of an institution, or certainly can be. And I wanted to commend that to you, to think of yourselves as, many of you I'm sure do, but think of yourself as the partners of the researchers in the institution and the teachers and so on, and to participate where you can, especially as we face a climate of diminishing and probably constant budget reductions as we are and will be over the next few years. So that's basically the comments I wanted to make. That is, as you know, in my fifth year as president, I'm giving you what's important to me. As far as IT is concerned, there's quite a bit more as well, but those are the key things from my point of view. And if they're key to me, even though I'm an IT person by background, I think you'll find they're probably key to most of your presidents or chancellors or provosts or whoever you report to in your institution as well. Again, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to speak to you. It's a great great pleasure to be back at EDUCOURSE. Thank you very much.
Michael, thank you so much. You are an inspiration to us. May we all have careers as successful as yours. Thank you for making time. Thanks again. And I want to thank all of you for making EDUCAUSE 2011 a success. I hope it was a success for you. And as you go, please remember, this is where you'll find the best thinking in higher education IT. We hope to see you next year. Safe travels.
You can hear more podcasts by visiting us online at www.educause.edu/podcasts. Thanks for listening.